It was good. The soldier didn't fire, and that indelible moment passed. One of the cameramen, however, got trampled, and all of us got banged up in the panic. Many, including me, were tear-gassed. After a couple of hours of this pandemonium, I managed to make it back to the Sheridan with the best news footage I have ever seen. This was major violence up close and personal, and it was an important international story. This time I knew I'd be leading Dan Rather's program. No way. In perhaps the most stunning thing that has ever happened to me, all the videotape was taken away from me and given to a big-name correspondent who was also slotted into the CBS News to report the lead story. That man never even left the hotel to see what was going on. Yet the CBS producers made him the star. In the parlance of network news, I had gotten big-footed. To say I was angry is the understatement of the millennium. I got the hell out of Argentina fast, landed in Miami, and raised a major ruckus at the CBS offices there. The bureau chief, my direct boss, told me to pipe down. I told him to, well, rethink his tone. A few days later, I was called back to New York for consultations. Fine. I returned to CBS headquarters on 57th Street, marched into Dan Rather's office, and let loose. What the heck was this? I asked. What if a correspondent who wasn't even on the scene, Dan, stole your famous reporting during the Kennedy assassination? What would you have done? How can you abide stuff like this? Dan Rather was polite, and I think I saw some sadness in his eyes. He said he'd look into it. I didn't believe him. The next day, I began investigating what happened to my missing report from El Salvador. I went down to the underground CBS archives and searched for hours. Finally, I spotted the label. I found the videotape. It was sitting there on a shelf gathering dust. I grabbed it and dropped it on the foreign editor's desk. 2 weeks later, my story ran on the weekend edition of CBS News. Nobody said a word about it except my father, who told me I was an idiot for even going to El Salvador. After questioning the system in a very public and assertive way, I became a dead man walking at CBS News. Few people would even talk to me. Coincidentally, TV Guide was putting together a story on me and two other young reporters as future superstars of broadcast journalism. The magazine had been impressed by the swiftness of my ascent from local news to the network level. CBS, of course, was less than thrilled with this development and downright anxious that I might tell all about the big-footing situation in Argentina. But I did not. For once in my life, I kept my mouth shut and did not harpoon the company. I thought I was being sensible, and I really hoped I was going to turn things around at CBS. To this day, I don't know if I made the correct decision. Before CBS and I parted company, I had one final inning with Dan Rather and his boys. For weeks, I had basically sat in my New York office and done nothing, as no assignments came my way. But on a visit to Cape Cod, Massachusetts, I stumbled upon an amazing story. The tiny fishing village of Provincetown had become a gay mecca. Every Friday afternoon, the ferry from Boston would dock, and hundreds of homosexual men, ready and willing to party, would disembark. The locals were stunned at first. Then some of them got very angry. These were the disco days, and the weekend parties in the streets of Provincetown were intense, and to some observers, pretty shocking. The stage was set for a showdown. To my surprise, CBS okayed the story, and off I went to Cape Cod, accompanied by a photographer. On Friday night, we used a hidden camera to shoot the wild activities. On Saturday, we interviewed townspeople and some gays to get their perspectives. In a nutshell, the locals were very concerned that their kids were seeing stuff they should not be seeing. While the gays basically said, hey, look, we're entitled to vacation too. We can't help it if some people get crazy. The authorities should deal with them and leave the rest of us alone. From my perspective, both sides had good points and were equally represented in my script. It was a terrific television story with fantastic video, and no other network had it. Once again, I look forward to being introduced by Dan Rather. Once again, it didn't happen. By this time, I had had enough. I never got a straight answer as to why the story didn't run, but I knew the situation was hopeless. Years later, a high-ranking CBS news guy told me the Provincetown report was simply too controversial and Dan, according to him, didn't want to take the kind of heat it would engender. What I didn't know at the time was that Rather was fighting his own fierce rearguard action against the remaining Cronkite faction inside CBS who despised him. So Dan didn't want to give the traditionalists any ammunition. Be that as it may, CBS killed a legitimate news story it never should have killed. What else is new? A month later, I left CBS to take an anchor reporter job in Boston. 19 years after that, Dan Rather himself walked into the no-spin zone. That surprised me. Rather was on the broadcast circuit promoting a book, but a few weeks earlier, I had conducted a fairly intense zone interview with the chief of 60 Minutes, Don Hewitt, who was also selling a book. During that conversation, I challenged Hewitt about the soft coverage I believe CBS had given Bill and Hillary Clinton. Where was the investigative reporting, I asked. Hewitt seemed to enjoy the joust, but there was no question that I felt CBS had got into the tank with the Clintons. So here comes Dan Rather into the zone. I had seen him a few times over the years, and we were always polite to each other. But as the managing editor and the face of the CBS Evening News, I was still amazed that he would face what he had to know was going to be some unfriendly fire. I didn't waste any time getting to the point. Why didn't you do any investigative reporting on campaign finance or Clinton situations, the Chinese espionage, Janet Reno, Chuck LaBella, all of that? Rather answered, I think your definition of investigative reporting would pretty closely match mine, that is, not run-of-the-mill. Right, I said. Investigative reporting breaks news. I don't know whether we broke news or not, Rather said, but it seems to me that on those things like campaign finance and Janet Reno, we did as much or more than anybody else in the business. I pressed him. Can you give me one story you broke on campaign finance? I think I can, Rather said. I think that when the, I'm drawing a blank on the man's name, the Hong Kong businessman, we were early in that story. That would be Riyadi, I said, the Indonesian guy who was funneling money to the Democrats from the Chinese military. Yes, Rather said. Jim Stewart broke several stories about the Riyadi case, and we tried hard to interview him, recognizing that something didn't smell right about the story. Now, I won't say we nailed the story. We didn't. But we did do investigative reports on it, Bill. Okay, I went on, but when you interviewed Mr. Clinton himself in 1999, and we have a transcript of that interview, you didn't ask him anything about the campaign finance stuff. Fair enough, Rather answered. Listen, if you consider that fair criticism, I have no argument with it. Look, I'm not a perfect interviewer. I continued, but it seems to me that with Mr. Clinton in that regard, CBS, NBC, ABC, and CNN were almost passive. I don't think that's right, Dan Rather said. Well, where did you guys break any stories? We were the ones who had Johnny Chung on first, Chuck LaBella, head campaign finance investigator for the Justice Department, and so on. Why are they coming on The Factor instead of the network news? Well, I don't know the answer to that question, Rather said. I compliment you if you had them first. Tip of the Stetson to you. But this much I want clearly understood. We don't do it perfectly. We do it as well as we can do it. I accept your criticism. But what is not true is that there's an inner bias with us that goes easy on the Clintons and hard on somebody on the Republican side. The record does not show that. In my career, I've tried to blow lights out on both sides of the street. Now, it's obvious your view is that I don't blow the lights out as much on the Democratic side as on the Republican side. I'm not saying that, I answered. What I am saying is that the networks and even the news corporation, Fox, they're the establishment now. Journalists are supposed to be outside the establishment keeping an eye on it. My theory is that is not happening, that there isn't serious investigative reporting going on at the network level because the corporations have to do business with the powerful and they don't want to make enemies. We went through 8 years of Mr. Clinton walking an ethical tightrope. We didn't see much from you guys. Well, there are 2 points here, Rather answered. I think the criticism that we weren't tough enough on Mr. Clinton is overstated, although I accept it. What I don't accept is that there's a left bias, a liberal bias. I believe there's an exclusionary bias rather than an ideological one, I explained. Well, I appreciate that, Rather said. Now, the bigger point, which is, as these companies get bigger and there's less investigative reporting, you're absolutely accurate about that. You're absolutely correct about that. It is, by and large, 2 things. 1, money gets cut back. I'm not the vice president in charge of excuses, but there are fewer resources today to do investigative reporting than there ever have been. I interrupted him. Let me stop you. I got 9 people working for me. How many you got? Probably got 10, Rather said. No, you've got a couple of 100. We nailed Jesse Jackson to the wall because of his abuse of the nonprofit charity law. You guys and the other networks haven't touched the story. Now the Chicago media is all over it. why wouldn't you pick up a story like that? If you're that far out front, what is there left for us to do, he said. But we don't do it perfectly, Bill, but we do a lot of investigative reporting. We have to make choices. Having said that, I will admit there is a kind of self-censorship that frequently goes on in big companies, including News Corp. I do not exclude myself from that criticism. Do you really censor things, I asked him, because I never do. I don't believe that's true, Bill. I insisted. If a story passes my desk and it's important to the American people, I do the story and I don't care who's involved. I don't believe that, Rather told me. Well, in the past 5 years, I've taken on the biggest sacred cows in the country and I can prove it, I said. I think that you do fresh reporting, aggressive reporting, Rather told me. Now, on Jesse Jackson, you don't think we did a very good job. You're entitled. I almost laughed. You didn't do anything. I don't think we want to get bogged down in the small bramble bushes, Rather said. The larger part of the forest is a self-censorship issue. It has to do with ratings. There are no excuses. What happens is the pressure gets on to deliver an even bigger audience, and the belief begins to run strong that you can do it without the hard-nosed investigative stuff. Yes, but we have, I pointed out. We're killing the competition. My contention is this, that the powerful in this country protect each other. So let me ask you flat out. Do you think President Clinton is an honest man? Yes, I think he's an honest man, Dan Rather replied. Even when he lied to the nation and to Jim Lehrer's face about the Lewinsky business? Who among us has not lied about something? Well, I haven't lied to anyone's face on national television, I said, and I don't think you have either, have you? I hope I never have. So how can you say Mr. Clinton is an honest man, then? Well, because I think he is. I think at core he's an honest person. I know you have a different view. I know you think it's rather astonishing anybody would say he's honest, but I think you can be an honest person and lie about any number of things. Really? I asked. I do. See, I want honest government across the board, I told him. When I see a president lying under oath, I see a guy undermining the justice system of this country. Rather said, it's hard to be honest across the board. It was time to move on. Let's take a look at some other stories, I told him. What about the Juanita Broderick thing? Juanita Broderick, Rather said. To be perfectly honest, I don't remember all the details of that. But I will say that, and you can castigate me if you like, that when the charge is something to do with somebody's private sex life, I would prefer not to run any of it. Now, I quite agree that critical mass was reached during the Clinton years, so it was unavoidable, because it affected his performance in office. But I don't remember enough about Juanita Broderick. It was a rape charge, I reminded him. But basically, her allegations, Rather said. Well, Congressman Chris Shays, Republican from Connecticut, told us he interviewed Miss Broderick's rape counselor, and he believes her story. You respect Shays, right? Yes, he agreed. But what you basically had was the Republicans trying to bring down Bill Clinton. That certainly was true, just as the Democrats tried to bring down any number of Republicans. It's the way politics are played. So it was an organized campaign, and unfortunately for Bill Clinton and the country, some of it turned out to be true. But in that environment, we are going to be very, very careful so as to not make any mistakes. We're not going to report the news the way a Republican pressure group wants us to report it, any more than we are going to report on unfounded allegations against George W. Bush. My attitude has always been, show me. You bring me documented evidence, you bring me some eyewitness testimony, and by the way, I'll be sending my reporters out to find out if it's a serious charge. What about when you're the subject of reporting, I queried. Do you think the press treated you fairly about the Democratic fundraiser you spoke at for your daughter? Yes, I was treated fairly, he said. It was a dumb mistake, the worst kind of mistake. I'm capable of being dumb as a sack full of hammers, and this was one of those times. That really fed into the frenzy that Dan Rather is left-wing, I pointed out. Unfortunately, that's true, he said. Aside from an interview with Michael Kinsley, in which I told the Slate editor and liberal commentator to his face and proved it that he had attacked my honesty in a cowardly fashion, the Rather appearance sparked more news coverage and editorial comment than any other in the no-spin zone. The whole country was talking about it. The moment that really ignited interest was Rather's contention that an honest man will lie about any number of things. Quite a few Americans didn't want to hear that kind of thinking from a journalist, especially in defense of the polarizing Bill Clinton. Wrote Tim Graham, World Magazine's White House correspondent. What was Rather thinking when he decided to go on Fox's O'Reilly Factor? Was he so desperate to sell a few more copies of his $25 idealistic book on the American dream that he was willing to lower himself to suggesting that honesty is an ideal that doesn't really matter to him? Another scribe noted in the National Review that Rather's remarks prove that you can be a network news grandee and bring out your moral relativism for all to see, unblushing and unashamed, when you have been cocooned among our agnostic elites for so long you think their attitudes are unremarkable. That same writer likened the byplay between your humble correspondent and Dan Rather to the movie The Cincinnati Kid. I guess I was playing the Steve McQueen part and Dan was the elder statesman played by Edward G. Robinson. At least I hope that's what the writer had in mind. Anyway, when my assistant buzzed me the day after the Rather interview and announced that Dan was on the line, I was prepared for the worst, but Rather was complimentary and told me I did my job, the same job I tried to do for him all those years ago. Life is like that. You never know what will come around. I have never disliked Dan Rather and have followed his career closely. That interview with him is one of my all-time favorites, and I respect him for engaging the zone. What we talked about really matters. The conversation vividly demonstrates the difference between us. I am a journalist who insists on honest government. I'm an absolutist, some say fanatic, in that way. Lie, cheat, steal in a public arena? I'm going to let you have it, and I don't care who you are. Dan Rather is more of a pragmatist. He indeed has seen it all and is willing to tolerate far more shenanigans than I am. He understands that a certain amount of corruption is built into the system and is willing to play by those rules. I am not. There is no room for any public dishonesty in the no-spin zone, and we will expose it with vigor. I'll leave it to you to decide which journalistic entity is more relevant in the first part of this new century. The Zone is there, and the CBS Evening News is there. America is all about having choices, and one of the choices each of us has to make is whether or not to put our beliefs on the line and defend them in the toughest circumstances. Do you hear that, Hillary Clinton? Chapter 14, Issue 14, Dodging the Tough Interviews, the Opponent, Hillary Clinton, Senator from New York. Who's afraid of the no-spin zone? It's a question people always ask. I've already mentioned a couple of persistent no-shows, Jesse Jackson, of course. From stage left, Al Gore would not venture in. From stage right, Republican Congressman Tom DeLay said no to the zone after he criticized his fundraising techniques. Attorneys General Reno and Ashcroft have both demurred. And Hillary and Bill Clinton loathe the zone with all their being, since, to quote TV Guide quoting me, I'm championing the regular guy against entrenched power and lying sacks of spin. And I firmly believe the cowards are the long-term losers. Call me a conceited dreamer, but I believe Al Gore would have won the election had he faced me on television and acquitted himself well. If the former vice president had parried my questions with intelligent and straightforward answers, thousands of undecided Floridians would have either seen the interview or heard about it from friends. That would have translated into some votes. You see, most viewers respect people who entertain hard questions, even if they don't like their answers. After Al Sharpton appeared in the zone, I received scores of letters praising his courage, and many of them came from viewers who had never before found anything praiseworthy about Reverend Sharpton. But Al Gore wouldn't risk a no-spin interview in which he might have to explain things like why he was so opposed to public school vouchers, which would give poor families a chance to move their kids out of poorly performing public schools while sending his own children to private schools. I'm certain old Al didn't want to try to tell me why he changed his long-standing positions on abortion, gun control, and tobacco. Al Gore knew that his rehearsed stock answers, the kind he used on the elite media, would not have been kindly received in the zone. Hillary Clinton has also avoided me, but her campaign was successful. I have to admit, that astounded me. During a run for the Senate, Hillary shot down all one-on-one interviews with journalists she could not control. Even the legendary WNBC TV political reporter Gabe Pressman, who has interviewed everybody, got the big raspberry from Hillary until safely after her election. NBC newsman Tim Russert did get a few haymakers in during one of the televised debates with her opponent, Congressman Rick Lazio. But other than that, Hillary wasn't verbally challenged during her campaign for the Senate. Not that I didn't try. My staff called her office nearly every day, and hysterical laughter could often be heard through the phone on their part. Hillary enter O'Reilly's no-spin zone? Yeah. And in the next segment, Yasser Arafat will be bar mitzvahed. Meanwhile, Mrs. Clinton worked very hard. I give her that. She appeared in all counties of the state and met with every special interest group she could find. Sometimes she worked too hard. Speaking to a gay pride event, she suggested, according to the New Republic, that participants should show up as their favorite issue. I quote, "Now, for some people, that may be prescription drugs. You know, for others, it can be sensible gun safety measures, or choice, or the environment. I wouldn't mind seeing a number of trees going to the polls on November 7th. What? Many Americans know that I have badgered Hillary to enter the zone. Sometimes badgering works, but not with her. So I had no choice but to call her out. Shortly before the historic November 2000 election, I wrote the following public memo to Hillary Clinton in my syndicated newspaper column. Well, just 4 more weeks until voting day, Hillary, and you've cracked the 50% voter approval rating. You lead Rick Lazio by 10 points in the polls, and things are looking very well indeed. Your strategy of running around the state of New York talking in generalities seems to be working. And the fact that the notoriously vicious New York press has given you a giant air kiss is simply incredible. Especially since you have given the media your middle finger for the past 16 months. Your press conferences are tightly controlled, and face-to-face interviews with you are almost impossible. Your Praetorian Guard of Secret Service agents makes it impossible for the media to get near you, and your highly paid advisors reject almost every print and television request for a sit-down. In the past, this would have gotten a big Bronx cheer from New York voters, but now the Bronx is firmly in your corner. That's because many of the poor who inhabit the outer boroughs in New York City feel the government owes them plenty, and you promise to deliver plenty. Also, there are hundreds of thousands of new naturalized citizens in New York, and many of them love you. They could not care less about your opponent. As we all know, Americans do either love you or hate you, Hillary, and right now you're getting sugar from the majority of New Yorkers. Again, that's a bit strange because you haven't really done anything in the public arena, and New Yorkers demand performance on the field and success in the clutch. Your two major issues are education and health care. They are nice issues, Hill, but they are a bear to deal with, as you know. You oversaw the educational programs in Arkansas for 8 years while Bill was governor. In all that time, Arkansas went from 49th to 49th in the national educational rankings. Thank God for Mississippi. And then there was the health care ordeal. Bill put you in charge of his health revolution, and please forgive me for saying this, Hillary, you turned it into a catastrophe. I know, you learned a lot in the process, but people in Romania were mocking us. People who still believe that putting leeches on your body is a great prescription were saying, you know, I think I'll stay with the leeches. They're a lot simpler to figure out than Hillary's plan. But as Bill Murray once said in the great movie Meatballs, it just doesn't matter. Your run for the Senate is not based on achievement or vision or anything but naked power and fame. And you're winning. Isn't New York a great place? In the debate with Rick Lazio, you sounded a bit tentative. You also looked a little tight. But then Mr. Lazio did you an enormous favor. He invaded your personal space with his soft money challenge. Thousands of women who resent men throwing their weight around did not like that one bit, and your poll numbers shot up. Who could have predicted that? Not me. Hollywood is thrilled that you may be the next senator from New York, and this is great. The stars provide money, moral support, and the glamour that the New York press and many voters can't get enough of. I mean, Rosie O'Donnell is in heaven. I hope we'll be seeing you and your mom back on Rosie again soon. I'm sure we won't be seeing Rick Lazio and his mom, even though he grew up not too far away from Rosie on Long Island. Dave Letterman's guys wrote you some pretty snappy material the last time you visited his program, and that was nifty. You came across charming and witty. Maybe you really are like that, but how would anyone know? You never speak spontaneously, and you never answer direct questions on the campaign trail. You have your comments memorized, and the less said about anything else, the better. So, I'm liking your chances, Hill. If New Yorkers are for you at this point after watching you for the past 16 months, then hey, you've got it. Very cleverly, you campaigned on the taxpayer's dime, used the White House for quid pro quo campaign contributions, and somehow convinced the media to give you a free ride. Brilliantly done, Mrs. Clinton. The Senate will be just great. You'll vote straight Democratic on every issue, serve on a few committees, and maybe sponsor some expensive legislation. And the big prize might be only 4 years away. It's a great life, Hillary, and you're just getting going. Please say hello from me to Bill, if you ever see him. And if you ever need a house sitter in Chappaqua, you know I'm available. Your pal, Bill O'Reilly. Sadly, I never received a reply from Hillary Clinton. It's been a long time now and nary a word. Why? If she would talk with me, I'd even give her a copy of this audiobook. Rejected, I have to take my consolation in fantasies. Each night, while lying in bed, I visualize the interview. At last, we are together in the zone. Her pantsuit is peach, her hair perfect, and she's backed up by 5 Secret Service guys with weapons at the ready. I smile. I speak softly. I ask the following questions. O'Reilly. Madam Senator, while your husband was governor of Arkansas, you made big money in the commodities market, turning a $1,000 investment into something close to $100,000. According to the Journal of Economics and Statistics, the odds of that happening are 250 million to 1. So, how did it happen? I feign some nervousness here. Hillary. No answer. O'Reilly. In the Whitewater fiasco, your billing records disappeared from the computer system of your employer, the Rose Law Firm. Then 2 years later, they mysteriously turned up inside the White House living quarters with your fingerprints on them. How did that happen? Hillary. No answer. O'Reilly. Would you like a glass of water, Mrs. Clinton? No? Fine. Let's continue. How do you justify sending Chelsea to private school while opposing vouchers for poor parents who may want to send their kids to private school? Hillary. No answer. O'Reilly. A Mars bar, Mrs. Clinton? Snickers? Okay, just asking. What about this? 45 minutes after the suicide of your friend, White House counsel Vince Foster, you called your assistant, Maggie Williams, and sent her to Foster's office. Why? Hillary. Silence. O'Reilly. Another White House counsel, Bernie Nussbaum, removed files from Foster's office and refused to hand them over to investigators, citing attorney-client privilege. Did you ever talk with Nussbaum about those files? Hillary, no answer. O'Reilly, to continue, it is estimated that you used millions of taxpayer dollars to campaign in New York State. You often flew to campaign stops aboard Air Force jets and logged the trips under your duties as First Lady. Was that fair? Hillary, standing up quickly and snapping, "You can shoot him now, boys!" The pistols are aimed, and then I wake up in a cold sweat. I have this dream over and over again, but the worst part is I have at least 10 more questions ready when the firing begins. Of all the people in the United States, Hillary Clinton would be the last one to consent to an appearance in the no-spin zone. Someday, somehow, I believe I may get a shot at her husband, Al Gore, and Jesse Jackson. But it would take a village of marauding Goliaths to drag Hill into the zone. As George Bush the Elder might say, she's not gonna do it. I wish she would. We could put it on pay-per-view. Don King would do anything to promote this. The Vegas guys would go wild. Please, Mrs. Clinton, take your seat in the no-spin zone. Do it for the children and for immature adults like me. Chapter 15, Issue 15, Not Liking O'Reilly, The Opponents, Regular Folks. Some weeks, more than 25,000 letters arrive in the zone. They come from people all over the world, sounding off about everything you can think of. And one of the most popular topics is me. How could such a shy guy generate so much, feeling? I can't figure it out. The feeling comes in all shades. We get plenty of good complimentary mail, and I try to answer as much of it as I can. The negative stuff is separated into a special pile. Because of time constraints, I selectively respond to both friendly and unfriendly fire on my television program. But in this section, I want to deal directly with some of the unfavorable letters. Here's why. Many of the pans are full of no spin. The zone likes that. The negative mail divides neatly into two camps, those who don't approve of my positions on issues and those who simply don't approve of me in my entirety. Let's begin with a correspondent from Vermont named Don. He wrote, "Mr. O'Reilly, every time I stumble across your program, I am amazed how rude and obnoxious you are. And no, there is no context in which it is appropriate. A typical rude American attitude. Yes, I am American." Don joins legions of people all over the world who see me as rude, but I can explain. The no-spin zone shuts down people who don't directly answer the questions or purposely distort the facts. In order to impose his own rules, I have to interrupt when a guest begins to meander or, well, lie. There are three reasons for this. First, I don't want to waste your time. Far too many TV interviewers allow their guests to blather on about nothing. Second, facts are facts. I have them in hand, and if the guest denies those facts, verbal confrontation immediately ensues. And finally, television is now run by computers. I have only so much time for each interview before the commercial break automatically appears on your screen. The machines have indeed taken over. I have to interrupt to stay on time. It breaks my heart. I'm spinning. It doesn't break my heart. I want people to get to the point. I want them to be pithy. I want them to tell you the truth or what they think is the truth. I don't want bloviating, equivocating, or weaseling of any kind. Chattis interruptus is sometimes desperately needed on television. So Don is right. Sometimes I am rude. But I don't mean it to be offensive. It's just the rules of the game. The zone rules. James from Ohio is next up. Sir, to be fair to you, I watched 3 weeks' worth of The Factor to get a full flavor of your content and style. In all honesty, I must admit that your program is a disgrace to real journalism. Your bullying style is neither effective nor admirable. Did you ever see Walter Cronkite point his finger in someone's face? Shame on you. The clue in this letter is the mention of Cronkite. Chances are the writer is a senior citizen who enjoyed old Walter's calm demeanor as he read the day's headlines each night on the CBS Evening News. In England, such activity is honestly called what it is, news reading. Walter Cronkite did not express his opinions. He wanted to appear objective and credible and fair. What I do is completely different. I analyze the news. I am the op-ed page of television. Many viewers don't understand this concept because it is brand new in prime time. The Factor is not a hard news broadcast. It is opinion and analysis. But when I give an opinion, the word commentary usually appears on your TV screen. We try to guide our viewers through the no-spin zone because we realize that we are different. Some people can handle it, some people can't. And some people, like Celia from California, are in the middle. O'Reilly, it seems pretty clear to me that you are quite proud of your bombastic, interruptive manner. I agree with several of your positions, but our country already suffers from so much incivility in the media. Must you add to it in the name of no spin? Celia is correct. I am proud of the zone, and I don't believe we are disrespectful to anyone. We are direct. I fully realize that some non-confrontational viewers, PBS watchers, find this offensive. But most of our guests and viewers return. Only a very few interview subjects like Clinton advisor Rahm Emanuel and Mary Frances Berry of the NAACP have stalked off in a huff. The zone is a serious place. Every day we deal with important issues and we follow the credo of the legendary band The Talking Heads. This ain't no party, this ain't no disco, this ain't no fooling around. Journalism is supposed to be tough. The truth is not easily exposed when propagandists are paid huge sums of money to spin lies and deceit. Celia is watching this all unfold, and some of it is unsettling to her. That's okay. Unsettling can be good. But then there's Norman, also from California. Mr. O'Reilly, I watch you on TV and have read your book, The O'Reilly Factor, The Good, The Bad, and The Completely Ridiculous in American Life. I expect that soon you will come out with music, a song something like, I'm marvelous. I'm wonderful to see. Why are you so conceited? This is another very common theme in the negative mailbox, and I have to admit that I am not a humble guy. But that's not my fault, as all of my ancestors were conceited louts. I need your sympathy, Norman, not your scorn. I need a government program to save me. But here's some no-spin on Norman's observation. Anyone, and I mean anyone, who delivers a strong opinion in America is going to be labeled an egomaniac. That's just how it is. In many parts of this country, it is considered extremely ill-mannered to voice a dissenting opinion. You'll ruin Thanksgiving dinner. You'll start a fight in a bar. You'll offend somebody. Dating Rosie O'Donnell or falling into a pit full of vipers is not the number one fear among Americans. Public speaking is. The country, founded on freedom of speech, is populated by human beings who are often deathly afraid of speaking up in front of a crowd. Your mother probably told you, mine did, that you should never talk about religion or politics. And what am I doing every night? making a career out of talking about religion and politics and everything else on the planet. For that, I take a massive amount of heat from people like Norm. Fair enough. But like Harry Truman, I can stick it out in the kitchen. Behind the refrigerator in that kitchen is often somebody like Barbara from Phoenix who finds me personally offensive. Mr. O'Reilly, you are rude, crude, and unattractive. Nothing personal, just the facts as I see them. No, nothing personal, Barb. And if you think I'm unattractive on the tube, you should see me without makeup. Dogs howl, bats fly in the daylight, blowfish giggle. Abdi, who lives in Houston, agrees with Barbara but goes further, offering me some professional advice. O'Reilly, I don't like the way you disrupt your guests. Please get some help from Larry King. He might teach you how to interview. I doubt it, Abdi, but then again, you never know. However, I'm not sure my ego could take instruction from Larry, and Michelle from Michigan would second that. O'Reilly, I quit watching The Factor because I find you so egotistical. So now my mother calls me every evening to tell me what I missed. I don't know which is worse. Michelle, 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 listen to your mom. She knows what's best for you, even if you don't, and I am saying that in all humility. Gina lives in Ohio, but I suspect she and Michelle hang out. O'Reilly, let me see if I have this right. If you make enough money, you can be arrogant and scream at people on your program. Why do you make a fool out of yourself? I don't know, Gina. I just don't know. As for the screaming, it is called passionate discussion. Just because a voice is raised a little doesn't mean there's screaming. I like to see emotion in a person. I am tired of zombies doing the news. Are you hearing me, Gina? Whoops. Sorry, Gina. I bet you never thought an audiobook would yell at you. And then there are the ideologues, the viewers on both the left and the right who absolutely go nuts when you criticize their guys. Thousands of letters poured into the zone after we exposed Jesse Jackson's non-profit tax returns. The document showed that very little donated money was going for charitable work. That teed Curtis from Los Angeles off big time. I can't believe a television network would put someone like you, O'Reilly, on the air. You are a racist and you can't furnish evidence to dispute this fact. Ah, the old race card. It is alive and well in America. You can thank folks like Jesse Jackson and David Duke for that. Forget the merits of our investigation. I am a racist for even bringing up the subject. Well, Curtis, all I can say is that you are wrong and your criticism is cheap. Drop that line of nonsense and debate the facts. You'll be a better man for it. And how about the Clintonistas? Whoa! They don't like your humble correspondent at all. I designate Brian in Colorado to speak for them. Mr. O'Reilly, the pit bull-like ferocity with which you attack the Clintons has strayed into the area of irrationality. There comes a time when investigative reporting becomes a witch hunt. Be a journalist, not a lynch mob organizer. What can I say, Brian? Bill Clinton will go down in history as one of the most corrupt presidents of all time. I reported that, and there's still much more to come. Keep watching. And of course, there is thunder from the right. Tammy from Tennessee is fired up because I believe homosexuals should have equal protection under the law. O'Reilly, why do you hate Christians? I believe the Bible is the word of God, and I take it literally. Homosexuality is an abomination to the Lord. Why are you so intolerant? Tammy, it is your right to believe in the Bible and live according to it. It is not your right to impose that belief on anyone else. I happen to believe that all Americans have a right to make a living and have a lifestyle free from religious judgment. As long as gays or any other group do not intrude on you, they should be left alone. Let God sort out the private stuff. He's smart enough to do that. There's something very peculiar about the negative letters, by the way. As you can see from this brief sampling, I get it from both sides, and each side is firmly convinced that I'm the enemy. How does that happen? Richard from Oklahoma puts me somewhere to the left of the ACLU. O'Reilly, you sneer at those who do not share your liberal views. You would make a good member of the super liberal gang headed by Al Hunt and Margaret Carlson. Not so fast, Richard. Alan in Connecticut takes issue with your missive. Mr. O'Reilly, how dare you consider yourself a journalist? Your smug attitude and unconditional love for the Republican Party is obvious. Is it really, Alan? Here's the no-spin truth. I am an independent. I vote for the most honest and most effective problem solver in the running. The politician I've most admired in my lifetime is Bobby Kennedy, a Democrat. The politician I least respect is Bill Clinton, a Democrat. Okay, test me. Go through my beliefs and come up with the appropriate ism. I believe that the federal government wastes a huge amount of the people's money and that most politicians buy votes with entitlement promises. I believe that global warming is real. I believe that the green movement has hurt America because it has shut down responsible energy exploration. I don't believe in the death penalty. I would not outlaw abortion, but I would restrict it and encourage Americans to see this ghastly procedure as a human rights issue. I believe in stringent control of hard drugs, but I would decriminalize marijuana use. I would suggest that the automakers develop cars and trucks that would be far more fuel efficient than they are today. If they don't, the government ought to slap a huge tax on them. I would order the Department of Energy to strictly monitor any kind of energy price collusion or gouging and impose massive fines on any company found guilty of those crimes. I would have the federal government negotiate discounted drug prices with pharmaceutical companies so that there could be an affordable Medicare drug benefit. These manufacturers should be pressured to be generous in their pricing and rewarded with tax incentives for complying. I believe America should maintain the most powerful armed forces in the world and develop a missile shield if the technology is feasible. I would eliminate the payroll tax and institute a national sales tax to cover Social Security and Medicare. The sales tax would slide depending on need. Those Americans who saved would be rewarded. The poorest would have more cash in their pockets. I support setting up federal prison work camps on federal land in Alaska for violent offenders. Murder, rape, hard drug dealing, and gun crimes would be punished at the federal level, taking the massive expense and chaos away from the states. These federal prisons would be run military style, and the violent convicts would, in effect, be banished from society. I believe our government should place the U.S. military on the border with Mexico to stabilize illegal immigrant and drug smuggling problems. The military would back up the Border Patrol, but would have arrest powers requiring the Posse Comitatus law be changed. In conjunction with strict border enforcement, the USA should set up a guest worker program if the Mexican government would cooperate. U.S. companies and individuals that need labor would be able to participate in the program, but it would be administered in an orderly manner and taxes would be paid by the Mexican workers to the U.S. Okay? So what do these beliefs make me? To what party or ideology do I belong? Tell me, I'd like to know. Maybe Tony, who lives in Texas, has the right take on it. Mr. O'Reilly, how dare you report the news from both sides? Who do you think you are, asking Jesse Jackson and others to answer for their actions? Keep up the good work. Millions of Americans like Tony get it. They know exactly what's going on in the no-spin zone. They see that we provide solutions to problems, not just vacant looks and general criticisms. They know that rank partisanship and irresponsible governance appall us. That's why the zone has become a power in America. The intelligentsia hates that. They loathe the fact that the no-spin zone has taken root. Magazines like New York and the New Republic spend an inordinate amount of time trying to convince their readers that your humble correspondent is, in varying degrees, a nitwit, poser, or worse. The New Republic even tried to portray me as one of them. Yikes! O'Reilly's insistence that he's an outsider isn't an affectation. It's delusional. Although his biography offers obvious proof to the contrary, he sees himself as separate from an alien, hostile elite. My biography offers proof to the contrary? Talk about delusional. The writer has no idea what the social or economic climate was in Levittown, New York in the 60s, nor does he care. The only thing he and others like him care about is trying to slap a hypocrisy tag on anyone who successfully challenges the media elite. But the popular media are starting to come around. Took a while, and we weathered some withering criticism, but in June 2001, I appeared on the cover of TV Guide, causing weeping and the gnashing of teeth in many quarters. The headline of the article read, "Bill O'Reilly isn't afraid of anybody, from the most prominent politicians to the most respected journalists. O'Reilly holds everybody accountable. For soft reporting, for abuses of power, even for social snobbery. The man who was once an outsider in television now has everyone's ear, and he won't be ignored." Not quite. The truth is, I'm still an outsider in television and in the corridors of power, no matter what anyone says. I am not and never will be a member of the club. It is the regular folks who have made the no-spin zone and me successful. Folks like Randy from Washington State who wrote, "Mr. O'Reilly, you have single-handedly revived my interest in the news. I admire anyone who has the guts to appear in the no-spin zone. Thanks for exposing corruption and hypocrisy." Well, you're welcome, Randy. Thanks for appreciating the zone. Chapter 16, Issue 16, You and Your Own Personal Zone. The Opponent, the World We Live In. This final section is between you and me, man to man to woman, man to kid. The question in play is, a most important one, should you establish your own personal no-spin zone? Don't react too quickly. The answer is not as obvious as you might think. It's a question that only you can answer. To do so, let's imitate Benjamin Franklin's approach to making a decision. We'll make a list of pros and cons, and then try to balance them out. Pro: a personal no-spin zone will save you time, money, and frustration. It will allow you to make value judgments based upon hard facts and evidence, and, provided that you keep an open mind and examine all available credible data, you'll be comfortable with your conclusions on most matters. Here's the key that unlocks the zone: the ability to be rigorous with yourself in always challenging your initial thoughts and conclusions. The zone is no place for zealots, lemmings, or weak-minded followers. It is a state of mind that demands the discipline of clear thinking and the flexibility to change that thinking should the evidence dictate. Summing up, the no-spin zone is not an easy place to be. Why? Because it's far easier to let others form your opinions for you. You then don't have to exercise your brain cells, and the crowd will readily accept you. Politicians, commentators, and others vying to fill your headspace are eager to supply you with particular points of view. And increasingly, many Americans are buying into viewpoints that crush independent thinking. Why think when media talking heads and newspaper columnists will do that for you? After all, aren't these people experts? Well, no, they're not. At least most of them aren't. There are no experts when it comes to making personal decisions. That's your own private domain. Sure, nobody's right all the time, and you won't be either. We are all occasionally defeated on the field of logic. But take your shot at forming your own personal philosophy. It's actually fun and satisfying to develop a code of behavior and a clear thinking pattern. Don't let pinheads, even smart pinheads, do your thinking for you. Ben Franklin would be appalled if you did that. Con: the biggest negative about establishing a personal no-spin zone is that it will alienate some people you may not want to alienate. Here's the best warning I can give you. Don't be like me. You don't have to confront the spinners head-on as I do. It's my job to be a pain in the butt or a loudmouth boor. But you can use diplomacy in your personal zone. You can conduct yourself with measured authority. Also, I only have an hour each day to get my point across. You have a lifetime. You can use finesse in the zone, and you can outsmart the spinners of this world. But why bother? I'm talking about a lot of concentrated, continuing work. And even with that, you are going to butt heads with people no matter how diplomatic you are. It's sad but true. Many Americans resent any kind of intellectual challenge, question some dopey statement they've made, and their response will likely be a personal attack on you. But here's some no-spin magic potion. Avoid those people. That's part of setting up a personal no-spin zone, avoiding cretins whom you cannot possibly win over. Very few people have actual power over you. You can safely ignore those who don't. Smile at them and wave as you walk away. There are more than 6 billion persons on the planet. You can afford to lose the hopeless and the misguided. So how about it, pro or con? Of course, I am the gatekeeper of the no-spin zone and its biggest fan. There are huge upsides in setting up your own personal zone. You will become more aware, exercising your God-given talents of perception and reasoning. You will begin to pay closer attention to the world around you. That leads to an improved ability to seize opportunities and avoid costly mistakes. You are far more likely to reject foolish, dangerous people who can betray your trust and dampen your spirit. You will take no individuals or issues for granted because you will be constantly making decisions based upon facts and life experience. In sum, you will be more alive, and this will add tremendous power to your life. Most of my acquaintances tell consistent tales of woe. They are always being taken advantage of or bamboozled. They feel victimized almost all the time. I'm sure you know people like this. But after you set up a personal no-spin zone, you will learn not to tolerate victimizers or charlatans or liars or manipulators. First off, you can just refuse to associate with them. And if that doesn't work and they are still having an impact on your life, call them out verbally. Do this only when it is absolutely necessary, but you have a perfect right to be fool-free. If a solicitor calls my home, for example, I tell them within 10 seconds that I don't do business on the phone. They can send me something if they like. Then I hang up. Rude? No. The call is intrusive and rude. Another example is that I have always instituted the two-call rule in my personal zone. If I call a person twice and don't receive a call back, that relationship is over. I then leave a short message saying that I will not be calling again. If it's a business matter, I turn the thing over to my attorney, an old friend I trust. If I absolutely have to reach someone for business, I call his or her secretary and set up a phone appointment. I ask for the exact time when I can talk to that person. If the secretary is unwilling to do that, I know the business arrangement, whatever it is, will not work. Other zone commandments? If I've made a restaurant reservation, I expect it to be honored within 15 minutes. Same with a doctor's appointment. The physician's time is valuable, but so is mine, and so is yours. Being on time and honoring your word are signs of respect. I only want to deal with people who are respectful of others, even in a casual setting such as a restaurant. Be aware of how others are treating you and question that treatment if you feel it isn't square. That's all part of a no-spin life. Now, you don't have to be as rigid as I am in my zone, and you can come up with your own set of rules. But believe me, nobody wastes my time, and no one cons me. I have a good broker, lawyer, tax man, and great friends, many of whom I have known for most of my life. I brook no lies, no deceit, no insincerity. I am almost the same off the air as I am on the air. Is that frightening or what? But the zone has worked for me. I have a good life. I am not a victim or a victimizer. I have never owed anybody any money, and I fulfill my obligations. I have two basic reasons for trying to lead a no-spin life. My time and my honor are valuable to me, very valuable. Hey, I probably don't have to convince you. I already know you're a zone-friendly person. How do I know that? Because you've stuck with me and my ideas to the end of this audiobook. I hope you have enjoyed the journey, and I am honored that you have taken the time to consider what I have to say. I can guarantee you that life in the no-spin zone is never boring, usually fun, and always challenging. While millions of others are indeed spinning their wheels, those in the zone are forging ahead, making progress in their lives without getting dizzy and disoriented. That's because we're on solid ground. That's the true beauty of the no-spin zone. It most often leaves you feeling clear and content at the end of the day. You have time for the important things like family and friends. The zone is a code, a lifestyle, a complete no-frills thought process. Believe me when I tell you, I believe what I'm saying and am in the zone for the long run. In fact, even longer, because I've set aside these words to be engraved on my tombstone. He'll never spin in his grave. This is Bill O'Reilly. I hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of the No Spin Zone. This program was produced and directed by Robert Kessler. Executive producer, Sherry Huber. Text copyright 2001 by Bill O'Reilly. Production copyright 2001, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.